Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Eddie Moretti. Welcome to the Vice Podcast. My guest today is Nicholas Winding Refn. I think I got that right. The director of films like Valhalla Rising, Bronson, Drive, and now the new film, Only God Forgives.
Ish.
You're not sure about that. You directed it, but you don't know if God can forgive.
I think that act of revenge and forgiveness is so embedded in our DNA that it's a consequential, the whole concept of drama.
So that is a theme that connects all of your work, obviously. You know, Valhalla Rising is all about that, right? Vengeance. Mm-hmm. Where do you see that? Why is that such a big concern of yours? Where in the world do you see this drive, no pun intended, to vengeance?
I think that vengeance is so primal because it forces us to take a moral view. You know, I mean, when people ask about the act of violence, it's, if you look at humanity, you were born as a violent organism out of self-preservation. Purely.
Where? What's the violent moment in our birth?
Well, our physicality. Mm-hmm. You know, we're born with parts of our body that can be violent, but it was mostly out of self-preservation, you know, the self of survival.
Right.
And over the years, we have ways to survive without the need of violent mechanisms. You know, mm-hmm. Society, religion makes law now that our teeth, our hands, things that are very violent parts of our body no longer has functions other than what we use it for, shake our hands.
So not as weapons.
No, well, it's no longer needed as a weapon.
Right.
But it's just a weapon if you don't have any violent impulses, then it has no function. So obviously we are born with a violent impulse.
Yeah.
And once you take those away, the vices and you know, castrates them, so they no longer need it because of society. We then fantasize much more about violence because we still have it within us.
Yeah.
But when it used to be an outlet out of self-preservation, it now becomes fantasy, more or less.
And is that the source of your violent fantasies? Are you tapping into that?
Well, I think that there is a...
You feel primal.
I think that primal works very well in terms, it's very accessible for a audience or a spectator to...
they recognize it, right?
To connect with.
Yeah.
It's an instinct. That's why there are certain laws in drama that constantly reappear from generation to generation. It's the same DNA that comes back. And It's the essence of drama, and of course vengeance is very much because vengeance is based on moral standpoint, and that's what makes us a human function rather than just an animalistic approach of self-preservation, which is the only thing an animal knows.
So two things. One, I want to figure out where vengeance and violence figures into your personal experience growing up in Denmark, but so that's one question. But before I get to that, I want to ask you, there's violence as self-preservation. Your films pretty much present these singular characters consumed with, you know, to act, and mostly to act violent. with very little sense, and maybe it's different in the new film, but very little sense that there is a group here that they're trying to preserve, right? It's not about, it is about singular survival and not about the survival
of an individual.
Individuals. It's not like a small tribe or the survival of a family or a group. The new film is a little bit different because there is this family dynamic, mm-hmm. but it's really dysfunctional. But where do you, you know, where do you land on that? The why aren't there more, you know, sort of little social units in the world of your films? What's the attraction to this individual who's really out there all alone?
Well, I grew up in New York.
Oh, cool.
So I spent my teenage years, I came in 1979 mm. and stayed until 87.
A decade or so.
Yeah, almost so a decade. From I was so, 8 to I was 17.
Nine. Okay, so you came of age in New York.
Yeah, I would say I have a Danish passport, but I'm a New Yorker by heart.
And so what was that experience like for you? And
I think that coming to America without knowing English and obvious sense of isolation comes to mind. Mm. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's in the minute you're out of your understanding, well, not even home, but when you're in a world where there is no logic to the noises around you in terms of speech.
Right.
You very much observe the world. You're forced to observe the world in a different way.
Right.
Coming to America at that time, you know, was very different than it is now because it was really an event.
New York
all
was,
the way.
Yeah, New York was
Copenhagen
in 87?
No, 78.
78. So, yeah, New York was really different in 78.
But just the whole concept of going to New York was
right.
different.
Yeah.
You know, the idea
traveling.
Of a skyscraper, you know, I mean, at night you had to dial because it was a better connection.
Right.
It was that far away, and I think that concept of movement into an unknown territory mm. and being isolated mm. is maybe something to do with it.
Maybe.
But I'm not an analyst, and I certainly wouldn't want to go to one.
Right.
but I can see some of the mechanisms that I do understand, and it's okay to understand.
But just intellectually, are you interested in, you know, a similar type of character that you've, you know, portrayed in your movies, but, you know, putting that character in a more social situation.
The There's family a sense of isolation in mythology
right.
that the it's hard to fantasize about a tribe that's not very fetish-oriented. Mm. You must remember, I approach my films like a pinup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about what arouses me,
mm-hmm.
and not so much about. I'm not a political filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I don't touch upon social issues mm-hmm. as an agenda of a specific political mm-hmm. view or a social view. I don't have that form of interest mm-hmm. in my, you know, in what I do.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a group in Valhalla, right? Very dysfunctional group that
Valhalla Rising is very much about a specific religious chaos that was taking time in that period
right.
in Europe where Christianity was spreading
yeah.
up through the north and how it was devouring paganism. But it was a devouring in different kind of ways. It was even mutating. So Jesus would be sold as a warrior for certain people.
Mm-hmm.
It would buy people.
Mm-hmm.
It would conquer. And the idea that the First Holy War had a lot of people that weren't even Christians moving towards it because it was at a time when there was religious turmoil
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the search for some kind of meaning,
mm-hmm.
which essentially came with Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Society was essentially created as we mm-hmm. know it today throughout the world.
I really love that film. I think it was really, you know, powerful. And that long sequence, like, what was the vision? What inspired that film? Like, what was the central image you know, that motivated you. Like, there is that long sequence in The Mist. Mm. And to me, I was like, this is kind of what this film is about in a strange way. Mm. But I couldn't, you know, put my finger on it. But where did that scene fit into your, you know, your initial desire?
I wanted to do a science fiction movie.
It did feel Tarkovskian and like sci-fi.
Without science.
Well, yeah, without science. With just...
Because science limits you.
Yeah.
Because science is based on logic.
Yeah.
Like machinery.
Mm.
You know.
Technology.
Whatever we call it. There's a limitations to the imagination in it.
Mm. There was even a moment in that Mist sequence where I thought, that's, the film is going to end in here. But I saw the trailer, so I knew that.
You know what happens?
I knew a little bit.
They always give it away.
Well, I knew there was going to be some dudes on the rocks. But I think that
the whole idea of wanting to make that film came from when I was little.
Mm.
I'm dyslexic.
Mm.
And my mother read me a story about a father and son that travels to the moon in a spaceship. And on the moon, they find a cave. And in the cave, they find a human coffin.
That's a good story.
And I can't remember what happened.
Right.
Or I remember, but I've forgotten it. And the idea of doing a film about traveling into a mystery.
Right.
Taking it at a time where there was nothing, you know.
Mm.
See, when you make films, there's also the whole business side of how do you get the money.
Right.
So I went to some financiers and I said, Mads Mikkelsen, Vikings, action.
He's the craziest killer and everyone, done.
Done deal.
Done deal.
How much do you need?
But that's only the first act.
That was the first image.
Or the first image.
But, so I was able to get like $3 million combined out of Europe to do that.
And just out of curiosity, how did they feel of the finished product?
Everyone believed it was going to be a nail in my coffin.
Yeah.
Because I just came off Bronson.
Yeah.
Different. Which had been very successful.
Very successful, but a different, you know.
Different, completely different.
Completely different kind of film.
But don't forget, Bronson and Valhalla Rising were made back to back. Literally.
Wow. Yeah.
I went from one movie to the other movie.
Which one is your favorite?
You can't.
I know.
It's hard.
I know.
I have two kids.
I know.
It's not Sophie's Choice.
No. But, you know, was the idea to make Valhalla already in your pocket while you were making Bronson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like Only God Forgives was already in my head when I made Drive.
Got it.
Because I was really going to make Valhalla Rising.
Mm.
And then I decided to do Bronson first.
Suddenly, oh, wow.
Out of nowhere. And then I was going to make Only God Forgives, and I suddenly decided to do Drive first.
It would probably have been harder to make Bronson if you made Valhalla first.
I think that I wouldn't have made Valhalla the way I did if I hadn't made Bronson first.
Really?
It's like...
Explain.
Well, Bronson is like an all night of cocaine.
Yeah.
And next morning, it's all acid. Or the aftermath.
Yeah.
Or the... The shakes or the...
the regret.
The regret, the but guilt. Also the whole, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
A feel,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And with Drive and Only God Forgives, I can only almost now see a certain similarity in the constructions of the four movies.
Yeah.
That they are the effect of... A decision that causes everything to change. It's like a flip of a coin.
Mm.
They're the ends of both extremes.
Mm.
And there's no middle because I don't have time to think of the down of anything in between.
Mm-hmm. I like that about your filmmaking. That doesn't, you know, that you don't have, like, only God moves, really. For a slow... studied film with real deliberate camera work and pacing and stuff, it moves. Like, this is a story that keeps unfolding, and I think it's interesting. There is no kind of time or, you know, space to bother with a lot of the details, like how did they get there, you know?
Pinup magazine.
Yeah. Explain that like a little more.
It's like if you were to go take a photo, photography book, or even you look at your own wall. Mm. If you take all those images the way they are now and you go from, you know, left to right, how we observe story, it will, a certain pattern will reveal itself. If you were to mix them around and do the same thing again, a new pattern would reveal itself. But essentially, the right pattern would reveal itself. Mm-hmm. So all my film can start with, right, like Bronson was, I want to make a film about a man who wants to be his own mythology. Mm-hmm. And it's going to start with, my name is Charles Bronson, all my life I wanted to be famous. Mm-hmm. And it's going to end with a success. But the consequences is he's chained for life.
Right.
And on the horizon, the idea of going into the unknown at a religious turmoil and doing a film that's a science fiction without technology, mm-hmm. very much, it's like meditation in a way. Mm-hmm. If you look at the same constellation, like if you look at that image of those trees for 90 minutes, it's guaranteed to alterate 1,000 different ways, and you may even change your perspective of everything else around you. And Drive, it was about capturing a moment me and Ryan had in a car where I had this kind of, because I was also very high.
What were you high on? Pot?
No, I'd gotten these anti-flu drugs because I had a fever. In America, they produce these things that I'm not used to having in Europe. So it was some kind of powder you put in hot water and then you drink it, and mm-hmm. it completely made me delirious. And at the same time, I had a high fever. And we were driving in the car and our Speedwagon was playing, and I started, you know, singing, and I started to cry. And I came up with, oh my God, we're gonna make a movie about a man who drives around in a car at night listening to pop music. So we wanted to make a movie about that emotion.
Right.
And Only God Forgives, because I sold it as a fight. I went to some French people and I said, you know, a French film costs 6 million euros on an average basis. So I said, I'll give you 2 movies for 6. And one of them will be a fight movie, because that's a commercial commodity. They're like, okay. And I thought, okay, the most dominating image of any fight movie or entertainment, which is so enormous around us, is the clenched fist. You know, it's this, right. This image is so dominating, and there is a very singular vision of aggression and violence within it. It's like even just people doing this, we automatically step away, or we are conscious of a possible violent act. It scares us.
Yeah.
But it's also an extension of the male sexuality. It's an act of release. So sex and violence in the exact same definition.
Configuration. Right.
Yeah, it's not just a, it's like it's a sculpture that has both things. And when especially when people fight, that the clenching is so enormous that they sometimes shake because they have to be so strong.
Taut, yeah.
That on impact and the hand opens up, it's a sense of climax. Mm. So this act of sex and violence in one movement. And that, then I thought, okay, but if I did this, it's full submission, because it's the oldest form of prey. And I thought, that movement, going from this to that, that I could make a movie about that.
That's the origin of the storyline.
Of Only God Forgives.
Really? Is that how you create? Are you motivated, like?
Purely like a pinup.
Yeah. It's more than just a pinup, right? It's, I mean, does that come to you in a flash, or do you think about it and, you know, develop, do you get obsessed?
Think about it.
You get, yeah.
I think I actually came more into that because I was in Scotland and I was going through, my wife was pregnant with our second child and it was a very difficult pregnancy. So I was very angry because I was very afraid, essentially. Hmm. And it's almost when you're in doubt, faith comes in. And I'm not a religious man, but faith is very natural in our, when we're in need of it. And the idea that if there was a God who had the power to give or take life, well, I wanted to punish him for what he was putting me through. So the idea of a man wanting to fight God
began the intellectual
began this
process, right?
And then I came up with the police lieutenant, and then there was, and then Julian, which was the protagonist.
Yeah.
But then this wasn't really an antagonist because he was so larger than life. God is not an interesting opponent because he's on. It's like having Superman. He's untouchable. You can never defeat him.
Right.
So I had to come up with another antagonist, and I came up because the film is essentially also a revenge story. So the classic gangster royal family construction, you know, was his mother.
Right.
You know, which changes everything because we're so used to male dominance in that kind of configuration. But bringing in a woman and making it the mother automatically opens up a very complicated relationship because of the sexual nature of violence. And then the idea that she devours her children. She's like a heightened, everything is heightened reality, of course. But that's what fairy tales can do. You heighten reality because then you can, everything can dribble down in terms of our subconscious. Because authenticity is not interesting in fiction because it's no, you can never duplicate reality. But if you can heighten it, you can mirror it, which is very different.
Right. The police chief, is he chief of police or whatever?
Well, he was written as he wears the uniform of a Thai police lieutenant that's retired. But of course, nobody will know that except Thai.
Thai police.
But he gave him, he looked like a priest.
Yeah.
Because he had a white collar and he had this black uniform, which is how they dress.
Yeah. And when did you give him that device? The slicing of the.
Well, it's
fist.
Because the character that. The Thai police lieutenant, kind of the godlike character he's based on, or God, is God from the Old Testament, not the New One. Because in the Old Testament, God said, you have to fear me, because I will be cruel, as you have to love me, because I will be kind. So he's based on purely cause and effect. He's based on purely an emotional, instinctual reaction to injustice, or whatever comes through our lives. And the hands is the oldest form of punishment that we know of is the removal of hands. And certain cultures still practice it.
We have a documentary on Vice on the removal of hands and arms in Mali.
Okay, so.
In Mali.
It's still practiced many ways, but it's a way, because when you remove your hands, you remove a social status, you remove a physical status, you remove
a weapon, right?
A like weapon, you know, it's a form of a castration in a sense, you know. So the idea that that's, and it's a mark, so that you see it automatically. And then I remember, I'm very obsessed with my hands. See, I have very soft hands. And I remember my mother told me when I was little, I would always protect my hands when I fell. And when I was, when it was winter in New York, I had my mother bathe my hands in Vaseline and then put socks on them when I was asleep.
Why?
So when I would wake up,
they were nice and soft.
They were soft because if you think about it, on one level, there's a whole belief that if you open your palm, we can read our future within it. At the same time, the act of touching is so sensitive that the more sensitive your hands are, the more of an effect everything has around you. Mm-hmm. And then hands is a great way to understand people psychic of how they look at themselves, how they look at other people.
What do you think of me?
Interesting.
Good hands?
Not as good as Ryan's.
No. not, I guess not. A lot of people have. Were you attracted to his hands? Really?
Well, he has very beautiful hands.
Yeah. I look at hands, but not the way you do, but you were drawn to his hands.
Well, it's part of the story, so it kind of had to work.
But I mean, before that, like, you know,
no,
I don't know when you started collaborating with him or when you...
Well, that actually came very late because since I was going to make Only God Forgives First, I had cast a movie with other actors when I was doing Drive. And then after Drive had premiered, this particular actor that I had cast to play the Julian part drops out 3 months before we were supposed to start prep. So I'm like, fuck, I'm left with no actor. And I was with Ryan at that time in LA at a place we like to go called the 101. And we had just done Drive, and we had met in such a peculiar way to do Drive that it was almost like an opportunity arose to do another movie. And I really needed his help because I didn't know who else
to cast in there.
I was blank.
And then, because of the role, you looked at his hands and...
Yeah, I mean, come on.
And what? How did you meet him? What's the peculiar circumstance that
originally?
Originally, under which you met?
He called me.
He liked your films.
Yeah. We'd never met.
Yeah. He liked working with him.
I do?
Yeah.
Oh, he's the best, yeah.
So how do you... How, given like kind of the mythological space that you're working in, especially in this film, how do you motivate your, how do you direct your actor? How do you direct him? Like, what kind of discussions do you have with them? Because, you know, exposition and the kind of things that some actors like to know about who is my character? What's his motivation? Where was he born, or whatever? There is no exposition in your movies, and I think that's what, at least, you know, in Only God, that's what keeps it moving really quickly, because you don't care about who had Cheerios for breakfast or how they got into a car or out of a car. Why do you need all those setup shots? They're useless. I agree with you, but just give me an example of how you talk to your actors.
Well, it's a way of submitting to the actual act of creating. Because I shoot my films in chronological order, so it constantly is an open void as it moves. Now, I have a start, middle, and an end that I want to get to, like the three beats I have to get to. And there's also a specific script. But it's open to constant organism that can alter if it needs to be.
With
your collaborators. So with the actors, which is a very intimate part of that process. And giving in, as I think, submission means you give in to the creation by always asking everyone else, what would you like to do? Constantly reminding them that they have to complete give themselves 200%, because or else the creation will automatically exclude you.
Is that why you shoot chronological order?
So, well, I do that because also I get really confused. Because it becomes about, well, how, and everything becomes so mechanical.
Right.
And then it's kind like of, well, then I've done it.
Then, yeah.
Then you've already done it in your head.
Yeah.
But the act of painting is much more interesting. And I can't paint. I'm colorblind, you know, so I wouldn't get very far.
Hmm.
And I'm not very good with clay. I can't play music. I can't sing. I'm not a very good writer. So I don't really have a lot of opportunities, as Bronson would say.
Mm.
So film became it. And the idea of sitting with someone, and that's why it's so important who you cast, because when you're constantly asking the question, what would you like to do, it opens a discussion between you and the performer. Or Ryan or Kirsten Scott Thomas or Tom Hardy or Mads Mikkelsen, whoever I've collaborated with over the years very intimately. And then it's like, suddenly afterwards things begun to have more meanings. Because then when I'm in the editing room, the first thing I do with Matt Newman, who edits all my movies, is that we put the movies together in 1,000 different ways just to see what it would do. Like you would do here.
Right.
You would do a constant collage, and then slowly everything would reveal itself that you maybe subconsciously didn't know was in it.
Mm. But you've scripted this production, so you've shot in sequence. You're saying that after in the editing process, you let...
Completely. Cut everything back and forth, left, right, center.
Wow. What's your favorite part? Or, you know, that sounds like a stupid question. What do you enjoy more? The process of shooting and capturing, or that next process of rearranging and discovering?
Both have great emotional ups and downs in it. I think for me, my favorite part is just coming up with the idea, because it has no consequences.
It's the most important part of it as well, right? When like a powerful idea like this or this image and your hatred of God because of your newborn, I mean, that really, that part of it is the most fun because that drives
everything else.
Everything else.
That's the engineer of the motor.
Yeah. Do you ever feel when you get that image and that idea that's so fertile and generates so many other questions and considerations, do you ever get a little drunk on that feeling? And do you ever feel, you know, is that a eureka moment? Do you feel like, I have a thing that has a life of its own now?
Well, it's very, once you tap into it, it's you can't stop.
You're right.
And it flows, and it's very great. And you really can't be around people because everything is a disturbance. And so it's hard when you have children and a wife. So I have to find specific moments to do that. And it usually happens at night when everybody has gone to sleep. So I can, it needs to come out, it needs to exit, you need to, in excess, you need to get it out of the body.
Yeah. And do you write it to get it out?
And,
do you
collage index cards?
Index cards.
Just write ideas on index cards. Like
no
this.
Imagery, no, just...
I don't do mood boards.
It's conceptual.
Yeah.
Completely. Wild.
The mind is an incredible device.
Yeah. That's the film, in a sense, when that is the creation of the film.
Yeah.
And that's cool. Does it make you happy when you're going through that process?
Oh, it's great. It's the act of creativity is the ultimate high. And I'm very afraid of anything dangerous, so I don't drink alcohol, I don't smoke cigarettes, I don't do drugs. I don't do anything that's dangerous because I have extreme fear of pain. But creativity, when it works, combination, it's like the ultimate I mean, I was no angel when I was young, but it's like, it's the greatest euphoria stage of being. It's mm-hmm. like, it's when you become godlike, because the power you have and the flow and the purity of just the satisfaction, the, how it speaks to your ego and vanity, and there's an outlet, because creativity essentially is an outlet. If you're able to and accept all your demons within you, then creativity is better than therapy. It's a release pattern. It's like sex, but times a billion. And it just keeps on going and going and going.
I we run out of time, and this is the wrong time to run out of time, but I'm gonna ask one more question. That act of Genesis, right, that you're talking about here, have you ever gone into a production without going through that process?
Yes.
And how did it turn out?
I failed miserably. So I am very fortunate to have felt failure so hard that it literally killed me. And I needed to resurrect myself.
What was that?
It was a movie I did called, it was called Fear X. Many years, I was in my late 20s, and I had a great collaboration with many people in it, but I failed. And I failed because it wasn't about this process, it was about my ego.
Right.
And ego kills right. more creativity right. than any amount of drugs.
But there is an ego gratification, like you described, that comes out of going through that process.
Yeah, there's, but that's like a, because a, it's for me. It's
yes.
like, see, but it's very different.
Yeah,
because
I
ego
agree.
Is
I
two
agree.
Different things, because there is the ego of how other people see you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the dangerous mm-hmm. ego. That's the destructive mm-hmm. ego. And I've been there, and I've failed.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God I was able to rise, because it's hard to rise. And then there is the ego of just pure act of creation, which is another kind of ego that is not destructive, that's not dangerous, it actually is good. So your ego has the devil and it has the God within it. And you're always at struggle within those elements, like love and hate. And it's like, whenever the bad ego comes, usually in a situation where you're praised or where yeah. people love you, or even where people hate you because what you do makes them so angry that the people who love it even more.
Right.
It's dangerous. You always have to shy away and just say, you can't walk on water. Don't forget, it's the act of creation. You must forget all that comes afterwards.
Well, we're taught that ego is wrong.
Ego is not wrong.
But the connotations that, you know, generally people give are that, you know, egoism is, you know, vanity.
It can be, but don't forget, it's important to be young and egotistical and believe that Johnny Ramone was right in everything he said, because it creates a sense of fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have
a little fuck you.
You can't. you have to go through that.
Right.
It's part of being young.
Yeah.
And if you don't go through that, it's a great missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Cherish, you embrace your ego, but be very, very careful. It's like drugs. Drugs are bad for you, but they're fun. It's a hard balance.
Mm. Well, I wish we could talk all day. I love your new film. I wanted to talk about sticking, you know, your hand into your mother's belly.
That's very primal for men.
Yeah.
Because all men essentially fear their mother's sexuality, and yet they're aroused by it.
Mm.
Inside of you, there's a deep-rooted instinctual part of you that you probably will not even recognize or accept or even understand, that a part of you could have a sexual arousement towards your mother.
Is that what got booed in at Cannes? Was that scene? Or?
Well, some people loved it, some people hated it, but they're very vocal in Cannes. So either they would stand up and cheer, or they would stand up and boo. And it probably penetrated a lot of people's minds that to places where they don't want to go, which is what art is supposed to.
Well, I clapped.
Of violence.
Yeah. I loved it. Great job.
Thank
you.
Nice
meeting you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.